Okay. The lucky draw for the first question is, how does the mudra finger sign of the Buddha symbolize the Four Noble Truths and each of the three aspects of the each Noble Truth? They don't. The first time I've ever heard about that. So the mudra is the place of the hands. They've got nothing to do with the Four Noble Truths or the three aspects of the each Noble Truth. All it is, they have just the fearless mode. We're supposed to be touching the earth. That was when he was about to get enlightened. He told the Mara was saying, "What right have you to sit on this holy place?" And he said, "Because of all the good karma I've done in the past," and he got the earth to bear witness. And he got the meditation mudra. This one over here, it's not the policeman's mudra to stop traffic. It is the one which is to that city abide mudra, the fearless one. Just basically showing an open hand. And you can see remember Ajahn Jayasaro, a good friend over in Thailand, he used to say, when you can see the standing Buddha and putting his hands over here, that's the mudra when you're in a football match and you form a wall when somebody's going to take a free kick. Sometimes. But those mudras, they came in afterwards because no one ever took a photograph of the Buddha. So they didn't know how he put his hands when he was meditating. And so this is the sort of thing which came up later on in Buddhism. And in fact, in that time, just after the Buddha passed away, there were no Buddha statues. They symbolized the Buddha by a footprint or sometimes an empty seat or a wheel, but not the person, which is one of the reasons why, because there was no person who's called the Buddha. Just a group of what they call components of existence, khandhas. That's all there were. And afterwards, the people started to look at a Buddha as some amazing, huge, with lots of differentiating marks. But in the suttas, there are many cases when a person couldn't recognize the Buddha. Like the story of the monk who was also from the west coast of Avanti, like I mentioned today, and he was walking to see his teacher, the Buddha. So he'd been ordained by one of the Buddha's disciples. He'd completed his first years of training as a monk. And then he was, with his teacher's permission, he was going to see the teacher's teacher, the Buddha. He'd never seen the Buddha before, so he was walking. In those days, there was no aircraft. There was no Singapore Air or Silk Air or Scoot. There was only just walking. And so he was walking over many, many days. And when he came to a place, he knew the person apparently was a good Buddhist. And so the layperson, he asked, "Can I stay in your workshop?" Which was like a lean-to next to his house. He said, "Yes, certainly you can. There's some straw there, you can stay there." And then a little time later, another monk came there. And so he too asked, he said, "Okay, if I stay in your workshop?" And the owner of the workshop said, "Well, there's another monk here, but if he doesn't mind, of course you can stay there." So the second monk got permission to stay in this workshop. And then once they got their bit of straw ready, they started meditating. And it was like sometimes when I was young and stupid monk, sometimes I'd be here on the, this is usually when I was a second monk, I was here meditating and I thought, my vow is I'm going to be the last person to leave the meditation hall tonight. That's my vow. I'm a young monk and I can out-meditate anybody. And there I was. And after the evening talk and whatever, I got 9 o'clock, 9:30, opened one eye. There's still about three people there, okay. Closed my eye, 10 o'clock. Damn it, there's still somebody there. Come on, get out of here so I can go to bed. Total ego and pride, okay, to try and be the last one to leave. So, but anyway, this was like real monks, not silly monks like I was. So these two monks were meditating there, and they said, well, this monk really meditates well, so I should meditate well as well. So they meditate all night together, these two monks. And in the morning, sort of one of the monks said, oh, you know, you're a good monk, you know, you meditate well, you know, who's your teacher? And he said, oh, my teacher is this monk, I think Kachana or something, who lives over on the west coast, and said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I've never seen my teacher's teacher, the Buddha, so I'm going to walking to see the Buddha. And he said, and who's your teacher? He said to the other monk. And the other monk said, I've got no teacher. I'm the Buddha. I spent all night meditating with the Buddha himself, and bow, 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 or something. Just said, I'm sorry. He said, no problem at all. The nice part of that story, the interesting part, is that the Buddha looked like just another monk. You could not tell the difference. Except, obviously, he was a very good monk. And so he didn't have the spiky bit coming out of the top or the little bump. So in our Buddha statue over in the hall at Bodhinyana Monastery, when we first built that, we wanted to make it just like an ordinary Buddha. Like, you know, make it more natural instead of the spike or the bump or the curly afro. That's what it looks like, doesn't it? And I don't mind doing that because it's not disrespectful. This is coming closer to who the Buddha really was. And they said, no, you can't do that because it's like in sculpture, the bump on the top of the head, the long ears, that actually distinguishes, it's a sculpture of the Buddha rather than some other famous person. Even like Nigantha Nataputta, Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, had many statues of him. And people, archaeologists, know which one it is. If it's got the bump, that signifies the Buddha. If it hasn't got the bump, that signifies either a great arahat or Nigantha Nataputta, depending on what they look like. So that's why they said you can confuse anybody. It's a symbol. It's not real. It's a symbol of the flame of wisdom coming out, symbol of purity. And once you understand the symbols of the Buddha, the symbols of the hands, it doesn't really matter. The main thing is not to argue over the symbol, but it's actually make use of the symbols. So, this is a good story to tell because it's on this topic. Years ago, when I was invited to give the talk at the morning assembly at one of the big Christian schools here in Perth, Christ Church Grammar School, it's because I knew the chaplain there, who was, was also working in the Cancer Support Association, which it was called at those days. And so they asked me to please get there early, but don't go inside. I had to wait outside with the chaplain, the principal, and me. It was a top boys' school, when they had boys' schools in those days, Anglican. And so I waited there, and then just before we went in, the principal said, get all the boys settled first of all. He said, this is a Christian school, Anglican, and very expensive a school to go to. And he said that before we go, as we go in, there's a little shrine or statue of Jesus, and the chaplain and I will bow to the statue of Jesus. But you don't have to because, you know, you're a Buddhist. At which point I took the opportunity to complain. I said to the principal, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus. And he was wondering, what are you talking about? This is weird. And of course, the chaplain I knew very well, so he said, oh yeah, Frank. He said, that's okay. Let him do it. So I just said, why'd you do that? I said, well, there's something in that statue which I can look at and respect. That's what I'm going to bow to. I'm not going to bow to everything in the statue of Jesus because I'm not a Christian. But I can find something I can pay respect to. So I did that. And then I also said to him later on, that's why we bow to a Buddha. We bow to what we can see in that Buddha, which is respectful and helpful for us. So when I bow to a Buddha, the first bow is to virtue, goodness, trust. So that's a wonderful thing. You're in a retreat center here, which it's implied you're keeping the precepts. You're not going to go and kill each other in the middle of the night because somebody kept on snoring and disturbing you when you're about to get enlightened and they sneezed. They came within a nose of enlightenment and then you blew it. Oh, I see somebody heard that. They got that. Amazing, amazing. But you have your virtue, and you can even leave valuables around. And even no one will actually take it. You can leave your baked beans on there, the real valuables, or your dumpling on there. So you have virtue. And virtue just makes life just so much more easy and friendly. I can trust everybody. Which is, I know that when I'm in my room, you won't take my teddy bear. So that virtue makes for a very wonderful community. Secondly, I bow to peace. When peace in my mind, when I meditate, peace in the body, so everything is balanced, peace in any communities, there's not any arguments, or yeah, we have differences of opinion, but we make peace with this. And even, who knows, peace in the world. But whenever you find peace and peacemakers, that is where I can bow down very easily. And lastly, the wisdom and compassion. Whenever you see wise solutions to difficult problems. I remember this wise solution in London many years ago. I still remember as a kid walking down the River Thames on the bank. My father was very careful and make sure I didn't fall in because there were signs everywhere. If you did fall in or slip in the River Thames, call the ambulance straight away and you'd have your stomach pumped out because it was toxic. No fish in there. And that was, you know, environmental disaster. Until a very smart person on the River Thames Authority solved the solution in one simple act of Parliament. They said that any business, factory or whatever, which was on the River Thames, they could take water from the River Thames as much as they wanted, but their inlet pipe had to be a couple of feet downstream of the outlet pipe. So in other words, they took the water in, they processed this, processed that, and they put the water back into the Thames, 1 or 2 feet above their inlet pipe. So they were the first people who got all the muck and the toxins and the dirt and the rubbish. Usually it was the other way around. You know, you take the water upstream and put it downstream so someone else has to look after it. And that was actually cleaned up the River Thames. Simple act of Parliament like that. Or just like in Thailand, in Ubon when I was there. They had not enough places for the taxi drivers to go to the toilet, you know, to urinate. So there's always this wall, and they'd always go and urinate, and it stank. And they put signs up, so no urination. And that didn't stop taxi drivers. So they said, you'll get fined. That didn't stop them. But what really stopped them? They said, this is a place for dogs to pee. and no taxi driver would urinate there anymore. Because they just saw there and they were just embarrassed, ashamed. No, she stopped it. It was really good. Anyway, so that's why I bow to the Buddha statue. Virtue, peace, compassion, wisdom. And then when I told that to the principal, so that's a really good idea. And he was so impressed that had a whole busload of the kids came to Bodhinyana a couple of weeks later. And this is one of the nice memories. Together he said, can I look inside your hall? I said, yeah, you have to take your shoes off. So he's very happy to do that. And the two of us together, we bowed to the Buddha statue three times. Why? Because he said he wasn't a Buddhist, but he could see something in that statue he could bow to and respect. And that is why we bow to a Buddha statue. Anyway, hey, this is unfair. Three questions. I can only see. Oh, no, the one's underneath here somewhere. Okay, here we go. Following three questions. Ekagata, one pointedness of mind, in Majjhima 20. Buddha mentioned one pointedness of mind six times. Can you elaborate on one pointedness, how to achieve one pointedness of mind? Number one, you don't achieve anything in meditation. If you try and achieve things, you get your mind very tense and you don't get anywhere. As Ajahn Chah would keep on telling me, we meditate to let go of things, not to achieve things. Achieving is more ego, more sense of self. It's what even Chogyam Trungpa used to say. He was a drunkard, he was not really a good teacher, don't know what else he got up to, but he did say some wise things. And that was spiritual materialism. I am more advanced than you are. Na, 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 na. How many jhanas have you got? How deep are they? How many wisdoms you've got? That, to me, even when I was a layperson, that really reeked of ego and self. We're supposed to be transcending this self, not just making a stronger sense of self. So instead of that, first of all, we don't achieve it. This is what happens when we let things go. It's like the default state. One point, it's not one pointedness of mind. The word is ekagata. Aga means the chief, the peak, the summit. And you all know the word aga from its Sanskrit equivalent, Agra, the capital of the Mughal Empire, just outside of Delhi. It's one summit of mind, not an ordinary pointedness of mind, but a mind reaching to a huge peak of conscious awareness. And how it's achieved when everything settles down, and then you become still. Okay, today I have some water. So, Carol, would you like to be my assistant? She's done this before. You're too far away. Okay, no, you don't touch it, you just watch. Now, first of all, are you an honest, trustworthy young lady? Well, maybe late lady. Okay, yes, you are. I want you to tell me, when this water stops shaking, has it stopped shaking yet?
No.
Why is that? Because I'm not being mindful. I will now be mindful.
It's still shaking.
That's because I'm not concentrating. I now concentrate. So I'll be mindful. But wait for a moment. I've got to get my concentration together.
It's still shaking.
Is it still shaking?
Yes.
Come on. It's shaking more than when I concentrate.
Yeah, it's shaking.
So how can I get this water to be perfectly still? Don't put it down. Let it go. Stop grasping. Stop attaching. Stop trying to be still or one-pointed. And you leave it alone. And relax to the max. Now.
Yes, it's almost stopped. Yes, it stopped.
Yeah, good. She was breathing on it. So it stopped. That is how you get stillness. When nothing moves and it becomes perfectly still. Let go. And that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult for people to become still. Because you have to stop doing things. And as you stop doing things, your sense of ego gets less and less. You can't do meditation. Deep meditation, what's happened, is what happens when you stop doing things. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. If you start travelling, doing stuff, the path becomes so narrow, you can hardly stay on it, the more you do. So that's how we meditate. Da-da-da. And that's actually one-pointedness, the peak of stillness. After achieving one-pointedness of mind, Buddha mentioned concentration or stillness. Could you please explain how to proceed? You stop all this process of proceeding, getting to the next thing. So instead of going on to the next thing, you go in to this. There was this simile of the thousand-petal lotus. You've seen loti. Well, it's lotuses. If it was Latin, it would be lotuses. No, loti. Anyway, you can see the lotus over there, fully open. It's a great symbol of Buddhism. And how does a lotus open up? The light and the warmth of the sun in the early morning, the lotus is all closed up. When the first rays of the sun, its light and warmth, hit the outermost petal, it opens up, allowing the next layer of petals to receive the warmth and light of the sun, which allows the next layer to receive the light and the warmth. Layer by layer, one by one, the lotus opens up. And the deeper you go in the lotus, the more fragrant, the more beautiful, and the more refined in those lotus petals. And in that simile, the lotus is you, your body and mind. And to find out how you go deep inside is to find out the truth of what's at the center of you. What makes you tick? What is this body? What is this mind? What is the five khandhas? What do? The light of mindfulness, the warmth of kindness, compassion. What, for want of a better word, I coined the word kindfulness. Your kindness, body and mind. You find you actually open up. The body disappears, you go inside. You go inside to the present moment. You go inside the present moment, to the silent present moment. You go inside the silent present moment, and you find the breath is just there. You don't go looking for it, it just comes to you. It just appears when everything else disappears. You're letting go of so much and go and see what's inside. And you go in from the ordinary breath to the delightful breath. And from the delightful breath until the, actually full awareness of the breath, and then the delightful breath, from the delightful breath, it gets so beautiful, you get the nimittas, from the nimittas you get the jhanas, from the jhanas you get the arupas, and then you disappear. You're gone. Right in. The next stage is always within the stage you're in right now. That's what happens. Concentration, stillness, stillness. That is what happens. I have further question on Anapanasati. I understand that there are 16 steps in Anapanasati. I never do step 1 to 9 and skip for 12 and complete 6. Step 9 is nimittas, experiencing the jitta. And anyway, step 1 and step 2, they're alternatives. You don't have to do both of them. The long breath and then the short breath, or the short breath and then the long breath. Because sometimes your breath isn't short, isn't long. Have you ever tried to watch the short breath and it's not short, it's sort of in between? Have you ever tried to watch the long breath? It's not a long breath. It's not long or short. It's just in between somewhere. And how long is long? You know, is this, does this qualify for long? Or should it be longer? Short? What is a short breath? What if you've got things like asthma and you can't sort of, you know, breathe long? So in other words, what those steps mean is you know whether it's long or short or in between. Any one of those is fine. It's alternatives. You don't do stage one, stage two. One or two. The whole breath. Calm the breath down. Can you really do stages five and six? It's beautiful, delightful breath, experiencing piti and sukha. Really enjoying this meditation. And then the sixth, the breath becomes so delightful, it vanishes. It gets light in the mind, the nimittas. That's what Anapanasati is. Even though I could see bright light or exploding universe and enter deep meditation, I could not sustain it because you're trying too hard. From a group of Klesa Sutta, it may be due to doubt. No, because it's too controlling. So that's how to overcome the fear. Go back to the beginning. Don't do anything. A natural process rather than something you try to achieve. There are two suttas, 1-2-1 and 1-2-2, where the Buddha talks about the concept of sunyata, voidness or emptiness. What does the Buddha mean by that in the context of the Pali Canon? Is it the same as the Mahayana concept of sunyata, that all things are interconnected, dependent, and that there is no inherent or essential nature? No, I totally disagree with that concept of everything is interconnected. If it was, then there'd be no hope for us. We'd have to wait till everybody, because if you're not enlightened, then I have to stay unenlightened. So the idea of interconnectedness has nothing to do with in the Buddha's teachings. The interconnectedness, yes, a lot of time you can allow yourself to be connected to others, but you can also disconnect, turn off, disappear, unplugged from the universe. What a wonderful thing that is. Yes, you can be connected, help out, be kind, but there comes a time when you disappear. You disconnect. And anyway, concept of voidness. Voidness was always relative. Empty, but empty of what? So that's when they used to say, you go to a hut, oh, it's empty of people. And then you close your eyes, and it's empty of sights. And then you become, say, still, sitting still, empty of movement. Go deeper, empty of body awareness. You go into the present moment, you're empty of past and future. You stop thinking, you're empty of thoughts. You just watch the breathing, you're empty of everything else. You can't feel your heart, you can't feel your toes, you can't feel heat or cold, or you can feel it as the breath. And then as you get into the breath, you can just feel the beautiful breath, the delightful breath, and you can't start to not be able to hear sounds. The body's disappearing. And you get into the nimittas even, and often you're empty of the body. The body has disappeared. And then you're really emptying out. See how much you can empty out. See how much you can let go of. That simile of the hot air balloon. You go in a hot air balloon, you go pretty high. But then you can go no higher. You think, wow, what am I supposed to do now? So what more can you throw out from the hot air balloon? And you're looking, you've got your lunch, you've got your coffee, and your mobile phone, throw it all out. And so there's nothing left in there except you and the basket and the balloon. So how could I go high? I'm not in the Nirvana yet. So you think, I'll untie the balloon, throw the balloon off. And then it's just a balloon and you holding on. And then say, so it's not high yet. What should I let go of now? You. So you let go, you disappear, and then the balloon can go all the way to Nibbana. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. let go to the max. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if someone is in a lot of pain, is it possible they don't feel the pain? Thank you. Yeah, sometimes it's... What was it to have these people who like play soccer or rugby or something, and sometimes they break their leg. But they're so focused on the game, they just don't feel it. It's weird, isn't it? There are some times somebody is like under a bus and the mum comes along and the mum just lifts up the whole bus. No way she can do that in a weightlifting competition. Now, because you need to save the kid. So sometimes, as I was saying this in the idea of asceticism, there was this monk when he went to Korea for the, well, this was in the mountains somewhere, and that we're supposed to do this walk in the snowfields. Ajahn Gunhu was there, but he was too sick to go, so I went there with this Korean monk. And this Korean monk, he was missing two fingers. Because what he had done, he was supposed to have put it in the finger in the candle flame until it burnt his finger off. You think that's a bit sort of strong, but then he did it with the other finger as well. But, because this was all televised, and when it was televised on the top of the mountains, it was me they were looking at. Actually, not actually me, my feet, because I didn't have any socks on. I just had my Birkenstocks, but with bare feet. No socks on. And they go, wow, these disciples of Ajahn Chah, they can endure the cold. Our monks can endure the heat by burning their fingers. These ones. And so I didn't know what they were up to. I was just walking, just now mindfully. And they were just having all their cameras pointing at my feet. It's really weird, you know, with the cameras all over. So I've got some of the most famous feet in South Korea. It's a lot of old rubbish. But anyway, that doesn't make you enlightened, burning your finger off or freezing your toes. So, feel the pain? Sometimes there's ways of dealing with pain. Learning how to let it go. And those are the amazing stuff. And when people do have, there was one of these fellows, he had this such bad back pain that he was allowed by law, there's only about 5 or 6 people in the whole of the West Australia at the time, were allowed to take any medication, everything was allowed, whatever, any drugs, illegal drugs for them, it was legal at the time. Because they had special dispensation, because they were in enormous pain. I remember him telling me, he said, they had the first CT scans at the time, so they can actually sort of tell the degree of pain which you're in. You know, it wasn't sort of subjective, objective, to see how much things were lighting up in the brain. And he said his level of pain, and it really was helpful for him to explain to others, you know, how much it hurt. You can always say, it hurts, it really hurts, but how much? You know, it can be subjective. So anyway, for him, it was the same, and they could prove this, the same as if you were cutting off his arm with a chainsaw, no anaesthetic. The sort of pain that you or I would feel, that's what he felt constantly. And that was the scale of pain to make it, you know, real, so he could tell people that I really am in pain. And he was a fellow, he came up and he said to me, he said, I've finally done it. With a big smile, I said, what have you done? Because I knew he was meditating to deal with his pain. What have you done? He said, you got the ECG flat, no, flat liner. He said, oh, that was easy, I did that weeks ago. I got the EEG flat now, 2 flat lines. He said, you see all these people in the back of the hall there? They're the doctors and nurses from Osborne Park Hospital trying to figure out what the hell is... Sorry, I shouldn't say that. What is going on? What's going on there? So that's what he was saying. It's amazing. It's very difficult to do. But the Buddha was saying there's 2 pathways of pain. physical and the mental, emotional, the mind. The two darts, the two arrows, sometimes it's called. The physical and the mental. He said the physical, you can't do much about. The body hurts sometimes. The mental, the emotional, which he said is about over 90% of it, the major part of it, that you can do something about. You can let it go. Let it be. It's a tough thing to do, but you can do it. Okay, my goodness me, people have all been into the suttas. It was all sutta questions. In Majjhimana 38, the Mahatanha Sutta, that's great. Great wanting sutta. I don't like calling tanha craving, because it means just the intense form of craving, and it misses out the other types of craving. The Buddha teaches that consciousness arises, hey? There's six types of consciousness. Which one do you mean? That's why I always translate it as consciousnesses. And it's dependent upon the sense basis, just as there was a different type of fire according to the different fuel. Yeah, six different types of consciousnesses. The mind consciousness arises due to contact with the mind. However, at the time of death, the body couldn't support the consciousness. Which one? It can't support the five consciousnesses, this body consciousness, but still the six consciousness can support the mind consciousness. And how is this mind consciousness still dependent arise from the mind until the next rebirth? The mind is not part of the body. So that's what happens. The body stops. Even in people who have near-death experiences, the body's not working anymore. But still, the mind is there. A lot of time creates mind-made body, otherwise known as ghosts. I've got to be careful sometimes because before some people don't like hearing about ghost stories. Where's Eileen? Oh, there. Yeah. Shall we tell a ghost story?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, now which ghost story? Okay, the Singapore ghost story. Like a Singapore ghost story? Okay. There was a Sri Lankan who got very sick. And so I think her sister lived over in Singapore. So invited her to come to, I think, the NUS. Oh, no, yes, right. Singapore. NUH, yeah. So anyway, to get the best treatment. It was her sister. And so nothing was working. Her sister was in, not a coma, but paralyzed from the neck down. And nothing was working. So her sister, who was healthy, said, well, got to give a call to Ajahn Brahm. So she asked me, it was during the rains retreat, so usually I don't, really try and do as less as possible. But I said, well, look, your sister's not going to last that long, so yeah, I'll do some counselling for her. Over the phone, from Bodhinyana Monastery to the hospital in Singapore. And so she couldn't talk very much, just a few words with a great effort. So I was telling her what would happen when she died and give her some good counselling. One day, second day, the third day, the fourth day, never called. And I knew what had happened. She died. But the fifth day, her sister called. Sister would make the phone call and then hand it to her ill sister to listen to and to talk if she could. And the fifth day, she said, oh, my sister died last night. I said, yeah, I expected that. And she said, but I have to tell you, something happened which was really weird. And I have to tell you this, that the sister, my sister, sent me an email about 6 hours after she passed away, asking the sisters, please say thank you to Ajahn Brahm for his help. And that email was sent 6 hours after she died. For days before, she couldn't even speak or touch anything. It was an email from beyond the grave. In the spirit world, they have Wi-Fi. And that's actually weird, but it's a true story. And now I tell people the old... That was a true story. Now I know what Gmail really means. Ghost mail. So anyway. So yeah, I mean, that was a true story. Could contact people, even send emails after they were dead. I don't know how they do that. But anyway, that's the different fuels make different consciousnesses, different types of consciousness. But the five types of consciousness, those five types, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, they need a body, those consciousnesses. And the sixth one, the mind continues on until the mind runs out of fuel. No more wanting, no more mind. Da da da. Dear Ajahn, when I was 22 at a seven or 10 day retreat, I sat in meditation until I lost my sense of hearing and external sounds. Great. I lost awareness of my body. Yeah. However, that is one of my least favorite words. However and but. Anyway. However, I can still think if I wanted to. But I instinctively knew that I have to suppress thinking. I also saw light that grew everywhere, although my eyes were closed. I got to a point where I was aware in need to die or jump into something in order to progress. I started to feel nervous, and my thoughts were that I wasn't ready. I still had a life to live. You don't die. You come out afterwards. A wonderful experience. And I decided to come out of the meditation still feeling calm and blissful, seeing brightness everywhere. I realized I sat for 4 hours at a go. Yay! It has been 14 years, and I don't know if that was almost jhanas. Yeah, it was almost jhanas. But just to let go a little bit more, I don't know, he may have been into a first jhana, I'm not quite sure. But anyway, in the first jhana that's actually just coming out, nervous, and the thoughts were that I wasn't ready. I was probably just about to get in there, but he didn't go. Still had a life to live, a life to suffer. But no, it's wonderful if you could actually, next time you go there, you don't die, and you jump. It is a case of sometimes you're on a little precipice. It's scary because, you know, the sense of self and ownership, much of your ego has to disappear. Now, only temporarily, it comes back again, unfortunately. But then, when you're about to go in, why not let it happen? So one of the reasons why, you know, these things do happen, I know this one monk who said that he was very, very scared, but it was just so delightful. It was like you see this enormous bliss, but it's a bit scary because you have to let go of a lot of stuff. You don't know if it's temporary or not at the time, but it's only temporary, so you can get it back again afterwards. But, oh, you've got to let go, that's really scary. But then it's just so nice, and then it's so scary, what the hell? They go for it. And that's a lot of time. Without the joy, without the bliss, without the profundity of it as well, this is a very deep experience. It can't be bad. Then that is actually what takes you into it. So anyway, those things happen. And sat for 4 hours at a go. Excellent. 14 years. And I don't know if that was almost jhana. Yeah, it was. Close enough. But anyway, keep on going. So they said they were 22 at the time, they're 40 now, so they're 36. So 36 or 37. Now, I can see a few people, it can't be them. Oops. So who's 36? So you've got the ages, and then we can check this out, we investigate it later. Okay. We have Amitabha residing in the West. Is he? I've been to the West. You've been to what they usually call the Wild West. So, where is the West? Because now, in those days when they started, you know, concocting up an Amitabha in the West. You couldn't go to the West, but now you can go in an aircraft. You can go to the West, you can go to California. There's got bushfires there. You've got all sorts of stuff over there. And so Amitabha's there. I was there in Berkeley recently. I didn't see him. So sometimes that idea of the pure land. Have you ever seen a pure land? Pure land means pure people. It's not the land which is pure. It's the people who make the land pure. We're part of land. Okay. See the story? Yeah, come on, do a story. I answer my own questions so I can get my own way. This was a story I read a long time ago about a priest, Anglican or Catholic or something, and he gave a sermon. He had a new member of the congregation who knew he was a very influential professor from the university. So if he can convert this person, he just really, get along in his career as a priest. So he gave the story about having to believe in Jesus and God to get to heaven. But at the end of the sermon, the professor put his hand up to ask a question. You don't usually do that in church, but nevertheless, this was a very important, influential professor, so he said, okay, what is your question? He said, you've just been telling me that if you don't believe in Jesus or God, you have to go to hell. What about all those amazing, wonderful people who they didn't believe in Jesus? What about Moses? Jesus wasn't alive yet. What about the Buddha? What about Mahatma Gandhi? What about Marcus Aurelius? What about Nelson Mandela? What about all these amazing, really good, fine people? Who? What about, come on, a female? Aung San Suu Kyi. She's not dead yet. No, it has to be someone who's dead. Sorry?
Mother Teresa.
Mother Teresa. But she believes in being Christian. That's to be a non-Christian.
But,
they're not dead yet. Yeah. No, anyway, just whatever. It doesn't matter. It's just gender neutral. I'm trying to be as gender. Yeah, by the time the Buddha. Anyway, when. Who else could have it? I don't know. Okay, anyway, that'll do for now. Anyway, get the gist of it. And so all these people, really good, moral people, helping out save the world. What happened to them? What about Joan of Arc? How's she? Was she good? Sorry? I don't know. Okay. Anyway, what about them? Do they have to go to hell? It isn't really, it's not very impressive. If you're really good, you sacrifice everything for others, and you're very wise and really compassionate, you have to go to hell? And so the professor, he was looking at the priest, and the priest said, well, that's a very deep question. It might take a long time. So I'll answer it tomorrow or next week. When you don't know, procrastinate. So usually on a Sunday when he gave his sermon, Monday they have a day off to rest, relax. Tuesday he went to his library and just tried to get some books out, try and find an answer to this question. Couldn't find an answer anywhere. On Wednesday he called up one of his mates, another priest a bit older than him, and the other priest said, no, that's a very profound question. You'd have to go make an appointment with the bishop. So on Thursday, he went to the bishop, and the bishop said, no, it's too hard for me. Friday, I had to go to the archbishop. The archbishop said, you need to go see a theologian at the university. So on Saturday, he made an appointment, went to the theologian at the university, and the theologian gave an answer, but the poor priest couldn't understand a word of it. It was all gobbledygook with long words, which he didn't understand. So in the end, it was Saturday night, and he still didn't have an answer, and he had to give the sermon the next morning in front of this professor. So he fell asleep. He fell asleep at the altar early in the morning because he was worrying all night. And he had the dream, the really clear dream of being in a railway station. And on the platform, there was a train about to leave the station. And he asked one of the porters on the station platform. He knew what the answer would be, because as you would know in a prophetic dream, he said, "That train, would that be going to a place called heaven?" "Yes," said the porter. "And seeing you're a religious leader, you can go on for free." So he went on the train, and like in dreams, that train arrived in the platform really quickly, and he could see on the platform they had the name of the destination, Heaven. It was heaven. And he got out there, and he went up to somebody and said, "This is heaven." "Oh, yeah, it's heaven. Welcome. Do you want to sit down?" He said, "Okay, I'll sit down. But can I ask you a couple of questions first of all?" And the priest asked this gentleman who was wearing white, had a little donut on top of his head. "Donut, halo. Okay, I'll try my best." Wearing white, looking saintly. And he said, "How long have you been up here?" That's my first one. He said, "Oh, a couple of thousand years." "Oh, that's good. You're the sort of person I want to ask." He said, "Is there anyone up here called the Buddha?" "Buddha? Buddha? I've never heard of him. He's not up here." "What about Mahatma Gandhi?" "No, don't know him." "What about, what are the other ones?" Nelson Mandela. "No, he's not up here." And all these wonderful people said, "No, they're not up here." And the priest had his answer. He said, "Yep, the Bible is true, they're not up here. But then, there's another train on the station, another platform." And he knew to make sure he had to check out this other place. So he went up to the porter and said, "That train over there, that wouldn't be going to a place called hell, would it?" He said, "Yeah, it would." So he bought a return ticket and got on. And in no time at all, the train pulled into another station platform and he got out. As you could see on there, H-E-L-L, hell, there's the name of the station. And when he got out, this guy came up and said, "Welcome, sir. Oh, nice. Must have had a long journey. Come and sit down. Do you want a cup of tea? Do you want something to drink? How about some food? We've got lots of stuff up here. How can I help you?" And he said, "Well, you're very, very nice. But look, is this really hell?" "Yeah, it is. Welcome. Look, you must be very tired. You must have want something to eat. Can I give you a foot massage or something?" He said, "Well, you know, you're really, really nice and kind." "Oh, yeah, you know, that's what hell is like these days." And he said, "Look, I don't believe this. How long have you been up here?" "I've been up here thousands of years," said this guy. He said, "Great. Is there anyone here called the Buddha?" "Oh, the Buddha. So wise, so peaceful, so compassionate. Nelson Mandela, oh, he was an amazing fellow. He's so wise. Gandhi, he would sacrifice his life. He's just non-violent. He's an amazing. We're so happy to have these people down here." And the priest said, "Look, this is really weird. Because in my book it says that these people should be down here. But this place is more happy, more pleasurable, more peaceful than heaven. Hell's supposed to be a place of torment and suffering." And I said, "Oh yeah, it used to be like that before the Buddha came down here." So of course, you know, that is totally against the books, and some Buddhist theologians would really, you know, crucify me or something. But it is the people who make the place, not the place which makes the people. You create your hells, and you create your heavens. Nidrajan, okay. In the sutta today about fetters, they weren't translated as craving and lust, I think. No, the fetters are some yojanas. They are part of craving and lust. And they said, where did that craving and lust come from? What they were saying is the personality view. That was the fetter. It included the five hindrances? Of course. Is the liberation of the mind the same as nirvana? There are two types of nirvana. Nirvana with residue remaining. In other words, you're totally enlightened, but the five khandhas are still going on. Like a Buddha, totally enlightened, but still living. And we've got the nirvana with nothing remaining. Total extinction. Saparisesa nirvana. Saparisesa means just everything gone. No, sorry, the other way around. Aparisesa nirvana. Without anything remaining at all. Totally gone. That's why they call it pari-nibbana. And pari means total, complete, absolute, one, nothing left at all. So the liberation of mind, that is the way in to the satparisesa nibbana, with things remaining. So when you're an arahat, until the time that your five khandhas disappear, until the time basically where they say you die, and then at that time, you're gone. Nothing remaining. It is the same as nirvana with things remaining. Sakaya ditti, or identity view, arises because the worldling takes the five aggregates as a self. That's the Buddha teachings. So in other words, the worldling, what's the difference between the worldling and the five aggregates? The worldling is the five aggregates. That's why they say, I'll do that next one. To see the five aggregates as anatta, who is this identity person that sees, contemplates the five aggregates as anatta, since a being is made upon the five aggregates? So you see that the five aggregates which just passed away were not me, not mine, not a self. You use the five aggregates to see through the illusion of five aggregates, to see the cause and effect relationship. Which is why that when even we are mindful of what you're listening to right now, there's always a time lag. Takes a few, I think it was about a third or fourth of a second before what you hear registers in your mind. That's the Descartes, where he said, I think, therefore I know. I think, therefore I knew. You put the time lag in there that answers the question. Self-identity is not that I know I am, I know I was. The whippalazas of distortion are the wrong view of Nietzsche, sukha atta, or permanence, happiness, self, and purity. Is it appropriate to say that the nature of nibbana is the opposite of permanence, happiness, self, and purity? Ha ha, not at all. Nibbana means that the simile of the fire, the Akawacha Gota Sutta, but I prefer to adapt that to the simile of a candle flame. A candle flame depends upon three things, three causes to keep it going. The wax. If that runs out, then the candle flame is extinguished. The wick. If the wick is exhausted, it's all burnt up, then the candle flame is extinguished. Or if a wind blows the candle flame out, in other words, takes the heat away, then the flame is exhausted. So the candle flame, it relies upon three causes. The wick, the wax, and the heat. And if any one of those disappears, then so does the flame. But when it goes out, where does the flame go? If it's been a really good flame, does it go up to heaven to keep all the saints nice and warm and to make their noodles in the morning? Because, I mean, what would heaven be without dumplings? Oh! Of course, it's ridiculous saying things like that. It stops. But you mean there's nothing remaining? Of course not, it just stops. And that was what the Buddha was saying with this thing about the sense of self. It depends upon the five things, khandhas or whatever. When those finish, it goes out. It's extinguished. That's what nibbana means. In the time of the Buddha, it's great learning Pali from the Vinaya, because that grounded it in personal experience. Mummy, the candle's nibbanaed. It's nibbuta. That's what it means. Every kid would have understood the meaning of nibbana in the time of the Buddha. It was an ordinary word used in this wonderful context. It's gone out, finished, extinguished. Where does it go? Same place flames go. Goes nowhere. So, sometimes people just do not realize just how profound was the understanding of Sir Elton John when he sang about Princess Diana as a candle in the wind. He must have had some Buddhist influence somewhere. I don't know how much, though. Remember that song, Candle in the Wind? I've never heard it, but I know it exists. In the section on contemplation of Dhamma, the Buddha in the Satipatthana Sutta teaches to see the erosion of the fetter in the six sense bases, how the fetter comes about, what is the insider knowledge the Buddha is directing to. They're talking about just not just arise and passing, but why it comes into existence. What's the cause of these things? And it's the fetter of craving a lot of the time. Is, ill will as well, keeps this whole wheel going round and round and round. Well, okay, this is part of that question, which is the first question. It's found its way to the bottom. How to get absorbed in nimitta, deep meditation, and enter jhana? Let go. In other words, just be kind and be aware. And be patient. Look, the Buddha often said, if you practice properly in no long time, you get all these amazing things. However, people haven't got a long time. They want it now. Or at least before next Saturday when the retreat ends. But look, imagine that you got it this evening. You got jhanas, enlightenment this evening. What the heck are you going to do for the rest of the week? So just enjoy it, take it slowly. So see if you can get your timing just right. Just at the end of the retreat, on a Saturday morning, that's the best time. You don't get enlightened, you disappear. So see if you can disappear. In the first sermon of the Buddha, Kondanya, one of the five disciples of the Buddha, had the insight, whatever arises is subject to cessation. What does that mean? He could see every one of the components of existence arising. In other words, see the body. It's pretty easy to see the body arise and pass away. See dead people and babies being born. Have you ever noticed something really strange? That when a baby is born, it cries, and all the parents and family, they laugh, they smile, they're very happy. Yay, you got another kid. The baby knows what's going on, cries its eyes out. And when a person dies, the person in the coffin, they're smiling. And everyone else is crying. Oh, so sad. We get it wrong. We should actually see the person in the coffin is smiling, so we should smile as well. The baby is crying, we should cry. Oh, poor kid. My best friend has had another baby. Oh, so much suffering. What do you reckon? You must. Okay, I've got a few more there. There was. I read this, they said it happened. I haven't got any corroborating evidence about it, but it's one of those stories, it should have happened. The baby who was born, it was in a US, I think it was a Californian hospital. And when it came out of the womb, it took a look around, still attached to the umbilical cord apparently, took a look around and uttered the words. The newborn baby's talking. Now, this happened to a couple of people over here in Perth. She came out of the womb, just only a few days old, and talked. English, clear. But this baby took one look around and uttered the words, and everybody heard it, "Oh no, not again." Imagine you could talk when you got reborn again. Having to go to school again. Wetting in nappies, crying out, and your mother's trying the very best, doesn't know what you're doing. Go to school, all the homework again. All that, all over again. Started from scratch. Oh my goodness. Would you like to do that? If I could sort of, tap you on the head with my magic, where is that bonga, this thing over here. And then you suddenly get a new birth in, what's the day today? October the 11th, 12th, 13th? October the 12th, 2019. You wake up as a baby again. What would you say? Yeah. Or you say, oh no, I'm really in for it this time. Would you like to be reborn? If you want to be reborn, what would you be reborn as? That disciple of mine, at least he thought about it. He said, if I want to be reborn, I want to be reborn as a dog. Now, usually that's a very low form of life, especially in Asia. But so what do you want to be reborn as a dog for? Now, think about it. Does a dog have to go to a school and learn Chinese and learn how to play the violin and stuff? Does it have to worry about O-levels and go to university? No. So what does a dog do all day? So does a dog have to go to work and make a living? All the dog does is just sits around and sleeps all day. And then just part of the job. It's not really much to sacrifice. Allow the owner to take you out for a walk. That's all you need to do, maybe a day. You get free health care, a nice quiet place to stay. Would you like to be a dog in your next life? Why not? You want to work instead. You want to go to school. He's almost convinced me what a wonderful life is until I told him. I said, well, because he was an Australian fellow, okay, Australian man. He said, in many countries, like Australia, that when you are born as a dog, after a few months, you have to go to the vet and get de-sexed. And he thought about it and said, okay, I don't want to be a dog. I know what he was up to. Anyway, what is this about? Okay. All that arises subject to cessation. What does it mean? If everything arises subject to cessation, including the mind, including your consciousness, does that arise? Of course your consciousness arises. So that's subject to cessation. Even your mind doesn't persist. It's not you. It's not yours. It's not a self. It doesn't belong to you. Yay! You own nothing. In the first sentence we discussed this today, the disciple is liberated from the yoke fetter by the cessation of delight and craving. Delight and craving in the mind and everything. Is this the same light as Kundalini's insight? Eventually, but his insight was the stream winner. Eventually it was solidified. How does one reach the state of dispassion and disenchantment? You just get lost, disappear. Dispassion, disenchantment. Those two words, which I think you are talking about here, is viraga and nibbida. Viraga doesn't mean dispassion. It means fading away. Vanishing. And nibbida means it's actually a revulsion. It's a negative part. It's what I call samsara's ejection seat. You have to have, like an aircraft, You have like an ejector seat. If the pilot gets in any trouble, you can press a button and the ejector seat pushes you out of the aircraft. I'm now going to tell a very terrible joke. It was, you know where hamburger patties were invented? They were invented, hamburger patties were invented by the US Marines. When they tried to install an ejector seat on a helicopter. I don't know, that's a gross joke. Okay. Somebody said, that's a terrible joke, Ajahn Brahm. But I bet you tell it to your friends. How does one reach a state? Oh, yeah, that's Nibbida. Nibbida just pushes you off the wheel of rebirth. What am I doing this for? The Bodhisattva, after he collapsed from extreme asceticism, recorded his experience of first jhana as a child under the rose apple tree. It was actually a long time after he collapsed. Could it be that torture and pain from this extreme practices made it unable to recall the experience of jhana under his true ascetic teachers? Not really, because it wasn't that bad that he could actually recall the jhanas under as a kid. Why not under those two experiences? It wasn't that torture, but what he did say was that please, his first teaching was please do not do that. Avoid the extremes of practices which tire and make your body weak. Atta gila matanu yoga. And also avoid the other extreme of indulging in the five sense pleasures. Kama, sukha, alina. Kama, sukha, nikanu yoga. Kama, sukha is the five sense pleasures. It specifically exempts the pleasure of the sixth sense, the mind. That's made abundantly clear in the Yavana Vibhanga Sutta. So, rather than they had not attained the jhanas, no, I think that doesn't really hold up under logic. That if they had attained the jhanas, then what they had attained afterwards would have been conducive to the achievement of enlightenment. Ajahn Brahm, this is a bit silly. Oh, good. Maybe I'll keep this to the very last, the best of the last. Could you explain the aggregates, volitional formation and consciousness? The main part of volitional formation is will. It is such an important part of volitional formations. Instead of calling it volitional formations, the key is there with volition being will, chetana. And when I'm going to go into the next sutta class, I'm going to do that word of the Buddha, because all these questions, they're asking questions which can be answered very easily by that sutta class of the word of the Buddha. I've done it a few times, but I keep on making it clearer. So that's coming tomorrow, word of the Buddha. The volitional, you get the quotes there where the Buddha says volitional formations means will. And consciousness, not consciousness, but consciousnesses. If you call it consciousness, most people mean mind consciousness, one of the six types of consciousness, but there's more than that one. And it changes the whole ball game. When you say consciousnesses, then they alternate. When one is there, the other one's gone. It just changes the way you look at these things. It's a play of different type of sense consciousnesses. When one is there, the other one has disappeared. So where's it gone? Where's the flame gone? It hasn't gone anywhere. It arises because of causes, disappears because of causes. There's nothing substantial there. These are the hardest for me group, and to add to confusion, sometimes the translation mental functions? Formations. Volitional formations, yeah. It's used instead of volitional formations, which seems to me something that is different. I agree with you. both of them, it's much better to call it wealth. If someone doesn't meditate at all and is only kind, that's only kind of a Buddhist. Instead of being a kind of a Buddhist, but being a kind Buddhist, that's good. Can they get enlightened just by being nice? By being very nice? You find you can't be very nice if you don't meditate. After a while, you get tired and grumpy. When you get grumpy, you get upset. Or you want things. You can't see things as they truly are. And you want things which you don't really need. Okay, so the silly questions. Only one. Dear Ajahn, this is a bit silly, but this morning you said Buddha's teacher was a Buddha. Does this mean there were more Buddhas before the Buddha? And there are still more Buddhas to come? Yes. No end of Buddhas. Because it's something which is in the suttas, I may be pointing out in the next few days. For you to be able to even get the first stage of enlightenment, a stream winner, you have to have a different way of looking at things. And that has to come from the word of another, Pautagosa. Was the Buddha an exception, that he didn't have to get the word of another teacher? Did he figure it out all by himself? That goes against the suttas. You do need the words of another Aryan, enlightened being, at least a stream winner, for you to see things in a different way. You can't do it by yourself. That's why they always say you have to associate, listen to the teachings of noble ones. Otherwise, it can't be done. So that's what the Buddha did. The Gotama the Buddha. He got his word of another from Kassapa the Buddha. Where did Kassapa get it from? The previous one. Now, even in science, that when I was at Cambridge, the Lucasian professor of physics was this gentleman called, keeps on coming up, Fred Hoyle, Professor Fred Hoyle. And he was the champion of steady state. And it was people like Hawkins was, no, Big Bang. One big event, and then whoosh, the universe starts. As if this was the only Big Bang ever. And I remember just going to Fred Hoyle's lecture at the, where was it, at the chemistry labs. They had the biggest auditorium in the whole of Cambridge. And I will never forget that lecture by Professor Fred Hoyle. I had a seat. Many other people, because I only got there early, I got the time wrong, thank goodness it was early. And there's people in the aisles. It was the electric atmosphere. There were two lectures. I think it was the anniversary of the 200th anniversary of the Astronomical Club or something. And the number two lecture was a guy who discovered quasars. He only got to number two. The chief draw was Fred Hoyle. He was a Yorkshire man. And his ideas just flowed out. If ever you have the good chance to hear some of these great minds, his was really up there with everybody. And ideas just came out of him. And there's people all different from geography and classical scholars. He was a person you could understand. And what he was saying was, even to this day, I think that, you know, he still, to his death, said the Big Bang is just the time scale. If you put a bigger time scale, of course there'd be many Big Bangs. And even Hawkins admits that, or at least he did. Many Big Bangs. Our world goes in cycles, never one-offs. If it could happen once, it can happen again. When people say, what do you mean about, you know, reincarnation? And somebody once put it very wisely, it's more strange than you're born only once. And you're born many times. Born many times is much more easy to accept. But born only once? So just life in cycles, round and round. the same as universes. If it can happen once, it can happen again. One of the most fundamental laws of physics, of philosophy, is called Murphy's Law. If it can happen, it does happen. I don't know who that Murphy was, but he really deserves the Nobel Prize. And so that's what old Hoyle was kept on saying. And that really, really, really inspired me. And still remember much of that, what he was saying. So yes, many Buddhas. If there can be one Buddha, why not many Buddhas? Okay, the thing about time. Very quickly, sometimes, years ago, centuries ago, people thought, this is the end of it, people thought that the earth was flat, flat earthers. We're far more sophisticated now, we all know this earth is a sphere. It looks flat, but if you take a bigger picture, you can see it's a sphere. Limited area. But no edges, no boundaries. And of course, then you go to space. This space has got limited size. It's only got a certain volume. But it's got no edges to it. And to get your mind around that, it's like circular. The universe is bent in space-time. So however far you go in one direction, eventually you'll come back to jhana growth. Not this is the centre, but every place is the centre of the universe. It's limited volume, but no edges to it. And even that was one of the things which I picked up from the biopic of Stephen Hawking, because my mate was even in that picture. That was Bernard Carr. He was a Buddhist. We hung out together at Cambridge. But he just followed, I followed Ajahn Chah, he followed Stephen Hawking. And anyway, even Stephen was saying, a universe without edges, without boundaries. Big Bang didn't start things. There was life before the Big Bang. There'll be afterwards. So anyway, that understanding that this universe is round and curved, the next step is time itself. If space is curved, no edges, why should time have a beginning, an end? In other words, an edge to time. Because if there's an edge to time, a beginning, there must be something before the beginning. It doesn't make any sense. At the end, what happens after the end? But when you get your head around curved time, no beginning, no end. That is beautiful. Even limited duration, but no beginning, no end. Like Earth. Limited space, limited area, but no boundaries. That, in science, we call beautiful. Solves so many philosophical dilemmas. Now, we look back upon the past and we think, how silly were the flat earthers, and how much more aware and educated we are. In the future, we look back upon flat timers, and how silly they were, thinking that something created all of this and something will end it. It goes on and on and on. Just like me talking, going on and on and on. Which I finish with the last joke, that they've started a society for people like me. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous. I've started On and On and On Anonymous. For people who talk too much. Okay, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay.